So, my first words of the morning here. This morning we're back on the topic of the hindrances. And the question that I got was, what should I do to nourish the hindrances? Which is kind of an anti-Dharma question. But that's what it said, so I'm going to do my best to answer it. And it was kind of an interesting exercise researching this topic, because I realized that figuring out what we shouldn't do is actually a good way to figure out what we should do, kind of by the process of elimination. So it's an interesting take on the topic. So the short answer to this question of what should I do to nourish the hindrances is basically not much. You don't need to do a whole lot to nourish the hindrances. At least we certainly don't need to do very much out of the ordinary. The hindrances will just naturally flourish without any special effort on our part. In the Dhammapada, we find this observation that I think somebody mentioned yesterday, that it's very easy to do things that are harmful to oneself, but it's very difficult to do things that are beneficial to oneself. So if we just let our minds follow their natural course, follow along the path of least resistance, then the hindrances will grow and prosper and live long. The hindrances actually have a tendency to breed kind of like rabbits. You may have heard the story of this rabbit-proof fence in Australia. There's a movie about it. And I just know a little about this from some of my Australian friends. But rabbits, I guess, are not native to Australia. They've got their own set of critters there. But they were imported by settlers to breed for some reason or another. I guess probably their skins or the meat or some combination of those. And it turned out that the environment was very favorable to them. They were very happy there. And one got loose here, one got loose there. They met up with each other. And before you knew it, they started to breed, and they were overrunning the countryside. There was a lack of natural predators. And it was really starting to wreak havoc on the ecosystem, on the farmlands and everything there. So they ended up by putting up this long fence, a rabbit-proof fence that somehow the rabbits couldn't get through, across some huge portion of the continent, this really massive fence that is kind of like a modern-day equivalent of the Great Wall of China. You know, instead of to keep the invading Mongols out, it was to keep the rabbits out of the areas that they hadn't yet colonized. So the hindrances are kind of like that. You know, if unless we put up a pretty major barrier to check their spread, they'll just overrun the mind. Unless we put up a really big eightfold path fence, then they'll just overrun the whole territory. So to nourish the hindrances, just let the mind run according to its natural inclination. Don't try to change anything. Don't try to train the mind. Certainly don't try to meditate. I found a great simile for this approach in the numerical discourses, which some of you may have heard me laughing over in the library yesterday. This is from the chapter of the 11th. It's sutta number 207, which is called A Thoroughbred's Meditation. And in it, the Buddha talks about the opposite of a thoroughbred, a wild colt, an unbroken horse. And he says, how does a wild colt meditate? When a wild colt is tied up by the feeding trough, he meditates, fodder, fodder. For what reason? It does not occur to him, what task will my trainer set for me today? And what can I do for him in return? He just meditates, fodder, fodder. So too, a wild colt of a person dwells with a mind obsessed and oppressed by sensual lust. Nurturing sensual lust within, he meditates to and meditates fro, meditates up and meditates down. Similarly, he dwells with a mind obsessed and oppressed by ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness, and worry and doubt. So that's the short answer to this question of how to nourish the hindrances. Basically, just don't go out of your way to restrain it. Don't go out of your way to train it. However, the Buddha did go into some more detail on this issue. He said that just as there are nutriments for all physical and mental phenomena, there are also nutriments for the hindrances. There are conditions that feed and support them. He said that the five hindrances have their nutriment. They are not without nutriment. And he spelled out this sequence of dependent conditions that nourishes the hindrances. And this was also mentioned yesterday. He said, what is the nutriment of the five hindrances? The three types of misconduct should be the answer. The three types of misconduct also have their nutriment, lack of sense restraint. Lack of sense restraint, too, has its nutriment, lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. Lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension, too, has its nutriment, unwise attention. Unwise attention, too, has its nutriment, lack of faith. Lack of faith, too, has its nutriment, not listening to the true teachings, to the true Dhamma. And not listening to the true teachings, too, has its nutriment, association with foolish people, which is always a good way to set things in the wrong direction. So in the sequence of conditions, we see, just summarizing the steps again, that association with bad companions leads to not hearing the Dhamma, not hearing the teachings because they're not interested in them, which leads to a lack of faith because you don't come across anything that's worth having faith in, which leads to unwise attention because you haven't heard anything to the contrary that you should pay attention in any particular way, leading then to lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. You just don't have any awareness of how to pay attention to what's going on, leading to lack of sense restraint. We don't know what's going on, we can't control it, leading to the three types of misconduct, physical, verbal, and mental. Things just kind of start to run amok, and that leads finally to the five hindrances, and there we are in suffering. But not quite finally, actually, because the Buddha goes on to say in this formula that the five hindrances then are really the direct nutriment for ignorance, which in turn, of course, is the driving force behind the whole cycle of suffering and samsara. So you can find this teaching in the numerical discourses, again, in the section on the tens, sutta number 197, called Ignorance and Craving. And Bhante-ji also covers it in his book. Some of you may remember seeing it there in his chapter 3 on the hindrances. As Sangha Ratna pointed out yesterday, there are a number of parallels between the gradual training that the Buddha prescribed for liberation and this series of supports for the hindrances. So instead of sila, there's the three types of misconduct. Instead of sense restraint, there's non-restraint of the senses. Instead of mindfulness and clear comprehension, there's lack of mindfulness and clear comprehension. So it's kind of the anti-gradual training, or the gradual untraining, the untraining of the mind. It's the path to making the mind less skillful, less disciplined. And it's the way to keep samsara going indefinitely, just rolling on and on. And as I mentioned before, that doesn't take any particular effort. So as was also mentioned yesterday in many of the talks on the individual hindrances, it's unwise attention, ayamiso manasikara, that's generally singled out as the main factor that facilitates the hindrances. I came across this very direct quote from Mahasi Sayadaw, who says that all demerit results from unwise attention. All demerit results from unwise attention. Or in other words, all wholesome karma that we generate is in some way related to unwise attention, to not seeing things clearly. So I want to talk a little bit about unwise attention, hopefully from a little bit bigger perspective than the individual talks yesterday, give a little bit more of the broad picture, and maybe I can manage to say something that wasn't covered yesterday. So on the most basic level, unwise attention is attending to things in such a way that we don't see the three universal characteristics in them, so that we don't see anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And the traditional way of expressing that idea is to say that we're seeing things through the lens of the four perversions. So we think that things are permanent rather than impermanent. We get fooled by the superficial attractiveness of things, and we miss the suffering in them. We don't notice the pain and pleasure and the repulsiveness in what we think of as beauty. This one on dukkha is a big one, so it gets two of the perversions. And we think that things really exist, that they have some substance other than what we give to them in our minds, what we invent for them. So we don't see the emptiness, the impersonal nature of phenomena. So in those four perversions, there's the one, the misperception of permanence, the misperception of self or substance, and two misperceptions about dukkha, that the painful is really beautiful, and that the repulsive is really, that the painful is really pleasant, and that the repulsive is really beautiful. So when we misperceive things in these ways, we're operating within a false picture of reality. We're not seeing things clearly or completely or accurately. This is otherwise known as delusion or ignorance. And as the Buddha was always at pains to point out, no good comes of ignorance. If we start from these kinds of flawed assumptions of permanence, pleasure, and substance in phenomena, then we're bound to arrive at flawed conclusions. But this is very much how we're accustomed to seeing the world. We're all very strongly conditioned to see things in this way. So unwise attention also happens pretty naturally, unless we really go out of our way to do something about it. In the Majjhima Nikaya, in Sutta number 2, All the Taints, the Buddha says that an untaught ordinary person does not understand what things are fit for attention and what things are unfit for attention. Since that is so, he attends to those things unfit for attention and does not attend to those things fit for attention. So unless we're lucky enough to come across somebody who tells us otherwise, we really have no reason to think that our view of the world is wrong. We really have no reason to question the assumptions that we're making about the nature of reality. And this is how most of the world rolls along if they don't have the good fortune to come into contact with the Dhamma. So I want to talk a little bit now about some of the ways that unwise attention leads to the various hindrances. And again, this was touched on in many of the talks yesterday, but I'll try to offer more of a big picture view. So when we consider the first two hindrances of greed and ill will, there's a particular flavor of unwise attention that's driving both of those, that's kind of common to both of those. They're opposite ends of the spectrum. And in thinking about this talk, I kind of came up with the term of selective denial. For those. The Buddha describes it in this way in the Samyutta Nikaya, in the Bodhanga Samyutta. He says that frequently giving careless attention to the sign of the beautiful is the nutriment for the arising of unarisen sensual desire and for the increase and expansion of arisen sensual desire. And also that frequently giving careless attention to the sign of the repulsive is the nutriment for the arising of unarisen ill will and for the increase and expansion of arisen ill will. So what are these signs that the Buddha is talking about in this formula? They're basically just the perception or the impression that we get of attractiveness or beauty or unattractiveness, repulsiveness, sometimes called foulness, from an object, person, place, thing, some experience. And that just depends on our particular conditioning. We all have our own particular likes and dislikes that will determine what qualities of something strike us as beautiful or unbeautiful. So frequently giving careless attention to those signs means that whenever we consider that person, place, thing, or experience, we basically just zoom right in on those particular qualities that strike us as beautiful or foul. And we find a way to ignore or kind of airbrush out any qualities that aren't consistent with that view. So when we consider things this way, it's like we have blinders on. We just see what we want to see and not the whole picture. And this isn't at an intellectual level. It's not that we consciously think that these things are uniformly beautiful or uniformly ugly. It's not that if we reflect on them, we don't know that things aren't perfectly beautiful or perfectly repulsive. But when our attention is careless, then our mind just latches onto those signs automatically. And it fixates on them, and it runs with them. And where it runs is straight to greed or hatred, as the case may be. And if you think about it, this makes sense. If something appears completely beautiful, then of course we're going to want it. Why wouldn't we? And if that thing really were perfectly beautiful, then that might be reasonable. But the whole picture is that there's nothing in this world that's perfectly beautiful. Everything has its flaws. So when we start from that flawed assumption, when we start from that flawed view of just focusing on the beautiful qualities and ignoring the beautiful picture, ignoring the bigger picture, then we come to this wrong assumption that that thing is worth having, worth wanting. And the same thing happens in the opposite direction with respect to ill will. We latch onto something about someone that's unappealing, that's unattractive, and we find a way to ignore or overlook whatever good qualities that person might have. There's no human being in the world, there's no being in the world, or even any object or experience in the world that's uniformly repulsive, that doesn't have some mix of good and bad qualities. But in our minds, if we don't pay careful attention, we just fixate on those couple of things, even if it's many things, that are negative, and we don't see the big picture. So our equanimity goes out the window. If it were really true that that person, that experience, that thing were uniformly repulsive, again, that would be a reasonable conclusion to come to. It would be worth hating something that were uniformly evil. But nothing in the world is that way. Everything is a mix of good and bad qualities, neutral qualities too. At a deeper level though, greed and hatred are really underpinned by the four perversions, as are all of the hindrances. They're founded on not seeing the three characteristics, from not seeing the deeper truth in things. With respect to greed and hatred, one that I see as being particularly operative is the perversion of seeing permanence in the impermanent. And this is really an essential ingredient for maintaining greed and hatred. It's really an essential ingredient for them arising in the first place. If you think about it, we have to really believe that there's some persisting entity there to either like or dislike in the first place. It's kind of an underlying assumption that has to be there, that there really is a person there, a place, a thing, an experience, something tangible that persists in time, that we can pin that sign of beauty or that sign of repulsiveness on. That there's no object there in the first place, there's nothing to kind of hang that sign on to say this is beautiful, this is ugly. So without that really fundamental misperception of permanence, that things are durable, lasting in time, there's really no stable object for greed and hatred to attach themselves to. It's when we see things as they really are, phenomena as changing moment by moment, then it's ridiculous to think about craving for something that's gone the next moment. It's ridiculous to think about hating something that's gone the next moment, about holding a grudge against someone who's not really the same someone from moment to moment. It's ridiculous to think about lusting after someone who's not really the same someone from moment to moment. We try to grab on to that passing moment with greed and hatred because we don't realize that they're fleeting. So we really have to see permanence in what is impermanent in order to feed, in order to fuel those hindrances of greed and hatred. The hindrances of sloth and torpor, I also see as being related in terms of unwise attention. And I see them as being at opposite ends of the spectrum of the energy of attention. So with sloth and torpor, we're paying unwise attention in the sense that we're not engaging our attention. There's not energy behind that attention. It's attention that's weak, that's feeble, that's not connecting. Whereas on the restlessness and remorse side, it's attention that's too strong, it's too focused, that's really crushing the object, that's grasping so hard, trying to sort it out, trying to work it all through. It's really obsessive attention. And there's unwise attention to this in the sense that we think that these ways of paying attention are good strategies for happiness. So we think that paying this kind of lax attention is going to make us feel better, basically. We have to really feel like disengaging our attention, just paying the bare minimum of attention that we can get by with, is really going to make us feel better. We'll just be able to relax. It'll be so nice if we just disengage the attention, don't really connect. And the same thing on the other side of restlessness. We have to really have some feeling that obsessing about what we're paying attention to is going to bring us some kind of satisfaction. And on that end of the spectrum, we're not usually under any illusion that it's going to bring us pleasure. It's usually clear that obsessive worrying and restlessness is unpleasant. But there's this subtle kind of pleasure that we see in it, that it's somehow going to be profitable, that we're going to be able to resolve something, we're going to be able to figure something out, we're going to be able to come to some conclusion, some evaluation of what we're obsessing about that will bring us some satisfaction. If I can just plan this one thing out, if I can just get everything ordered in my mind, then I'll be able to relax, then I'll feel better. So there's these mistaken views of the kind of tension that will bring us happiness. So in this case, I think that the perversion of seeing pleasure and pain, of not really recognizing the quality of dukkha in these states, is particularly operative in maintaining them. If we think about it, these are states really of great suffering. The experience of sloth and torpor is one of tremendous disconnection, of separation, of a kind of numbness. It's like taking a sabbatical from this precious human life of ours. It's a waste of time, basically. And the experience of restlessness and remorse is one of tremendous strain, tension, contraction. It really shrinks our world down to this knot of petty concerns. So again, it's a way of missing out on our lives. So the only way that we'll allow ourselves to really fall into and linger in those states is if we actually manage to think that they're pleasant. And this is exactly what happens when our attention is careless. This is unwise attention to sloth and torpor and restlessness and remorse. We pay attention to them in such a way that we perceive them as actually being pleasant, being worthwhile. We don't see the dukkha in them. We don't see the pain, the foulness, the repulsiveness in them. As Anne said yesterday, we perceive those prisons as five-star hotels. It's not that they're actually five-star hotels, but they have a superficial appearance that we can interpret that way if we don't look around carefully enough to notice the bars on the windows, the locks on the doors, the shackles on our ankles. We have to really overlook the painful and confining nature of those states. We have to believe that there's pleasure or at least some kind of value in them, even if it's that kind of masochistic pleasure that comes from beating ourselves up with guilt. If we opened our eyes to the actual suffering of them, then there'd be mindfulness and wisdom in the mind. And those hindrances would starve to death. They'd wither away. They can't hold up in the light of mindfulness and wisdom. Sister Sobhana mentioned this great quote yesterday from the Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta number 2, All the Taints Again, that describes the tone of the kind of unwise attention that fuels the hindrance of doubt. And I'll read it again because I think it's just so great. The Buddha says, this is how one attends unwisely. Was I in the past? Was I not in the past? What was I in the past? How was I in the past? Having been what did I become in the past? Will I be in the future? Will I not be in the future? What will I be in the future? How will I be in the future? Having been what will I become in the future? Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? So that's the thicket of views that the Buddha says that we get entangled in when we pay unwise attention to dubious matters. And it always just cracks me up, that passage. It really reminds me of the Who's on First routine from Abbott and Costello. It's just such a total jumble of confusion. You have to laugh at it. It's just such a mess. And it really shows how little human nature has changed in 2,500 years. I actually got an email from a yogi just about 2 weeks ago that was uncannily similar in tone to this passage from the sutta. She had just been to a seminar by a teacher from some Hindu tradition. I don't know exactly what it was, but the topic was dharma and karma. And boy, did she come out with some healthy hindrances of doubt. She sent me this great email. I wish I had it with me, but it had this whole rapid-fire series of questions. It was just so much like the sutta. It was great. So to feed that kind of rampant speculation, the perversion of seeing self and no self has to really come into play. Or in other words, we have to believe that all of those concepts about ourselves, about others, about the world, past, present, future, all of that kind of thing, we have to really believe that they point to some actual substantial reality, that there's some inherent truth in them. We have to perceive substance where there isn't any. That's seeing self and no self. We basically have to get totally caught up in conceptual reality, at least for that time that we're caught in that thicket of views, and believe that it's really the only game in town, that conceptual reality is the only reality, that that's where it's at. If we start to see all of those concepts for what they are, just as ideas created by our minds, then that whole edifice of speculation really becomes meaningless. We can't sustain it. And in fact, it is actually meaningless. So I'd like to end with just one last passage from the Numerical Discourses. This is from number 197 on ignorance and craving again. This is another water simile to add to the list. And this is the Buddhist simile for this process of nourishing the hindrances through the gradual untraining, through that sequence of causes, starting with keeping bad company that leads up through unwise attention and then fuels the hindrances and keeps our reservoir of suffering nice and full. He said, just as when there is a heavy rain high up in the mountains and the sky is rumbling, the water flowing downwards will fill up the clefts, crevices, and fissures in the mountains. And when these are full, they will fill up the little pools. The full little pools will fill up the lakes. The full lakes will fill up the small rivers. The full small rivers will fill up the big rivers. And the full big rivers will fill up the great ocean. Such is the nutriment of the great ocean. And so it becomes full. One thing that I like about the simile is it brings in this image of gravity, of the water flowing with gravity. That's its natural course. There's this natural process of the water working its way down from little crevices up in the mountains to eventually collect in this great ocean. And in the same way, if the mind just follows its natural gravitational pull, that pull towards unwise attention, then the hindrances and that great ocean of ignorance will be kept good and full just through the natural process of samsara that's been going on and on and on. It's the natural inclination of our minds, the conditioned inclination of our minds. So I hope that we and all beings will be able to eventually get free of that great gravitational pull, take a spaceship out of that field of gravitational pull. Thank you.
You can see in all this, we are talking about jhanas and what will be practiced to get to jhanas. We have hindrances and so forth. How can we get rid of them? Without getting rid of them, we cannot gain jhana. We have to practice vipassana, isn't it? So when we get jhana, almost simultaneously with the gaining jhanas, mindfulness also is developed. That is why we said these two go hand in hand. Dealing with hindrances and nourishing hindrances, we have to look at very mindfully. As she pointed out correctly, the number one nourishment, very powerful nourishment, is unmindful reflection. That is why people say, don't associate with the fools.